I'm John Fox Sullivan. I'm Chief Executive of Atlantic Media, one of the co-sponsors of this event. I want to thank all of you very much for joining us. Some of you have... Let me ask you a question. How many in this room have been here for the last 4 days as opposed to just arriving? So most people are pretty new. But welcome to Aspen Ideas Festival. Change. Senator Bennett this morning said that Americans expect institutions to deliver. Doug Schoen, pollster, gave us a lot of data on the first day. Some of you might have missed saying, by and large, Americans don't think most of their institutions are delivering. This is a panel which is going to take a look at that, and I think it's going to be an extraordinary session. As some of you might notice, neither Jim Fallows nor Walter Isaacson are up on the stage as they were supposed to be, but they've been replaced, I think, by a couple of extraordinary gentlemen. Jim Collins is going to be our moderator. Jim is well known to most of you as for his incredibly successful books on change, one on Good to Great and one Building to Last, where he's looked at how corporations deal with change and adapt. How many of you believe you've read bestsellers? Do you know what a bestseller is? Bestseller in this country is something that sells 30, 40, 50,000 books. Maybe a really good bestseller sells a million. General Powell, I'm not sure how many yours have sold, but I bet you're 2 million. 2 million, is that all?
I didn't ask for this, you know.
I'm good.
I didn't either.
He didn't ask. I'm doing it. Mr. Collins's books have sold something of the area of six to seven million copies worldwide.
Good to Great, I'm coming out.
Which is a rather extraordinary number. Gives a new sense of meaning of bestseller. But Jim, why don't you take it over, introduce our folks, and let's have fun.
Thank you. I don't know if we've sold that many books, but we got very lucky and have reached a lot of people. But I really am here to shine a light on our panel. And it's really an honor and a privilege to be here with this very distinguished group. My role is to set a stage and to tee up some questions that might be important for us as Americans, those of us who are Americans, and very passionate people who have a passionate love affair with this nation, as I do, to perhaps wrestle with. And I'd like to set the stage for our conversation with a very brief story. A couple of years ago, I received a phone call from Francis Hesselbein, who is the chief executive of the Leader Institute, formerly the Peter F. Drucker Foundation, and had previously run the Girl Scouts. And those of you who know Francis know that when Francis calls, there are certain times when she approaches you, you know that whatever she asks, the answer will be yes. And so Francis said, I'd like you to lead a case discussion at West Point. Would you be willing to do that? And I said yes. And then I asked, who are the students? Thinking it might be cadets or I don't know, but it was a gathering of people. She said, it's going to be 12 generals from the United States Army. It's going to be 12 corporate large company type CEOs. And it's going to be 12 leaders from the social sectors, people who run things like the Boys and Girls Club and major universities and so forth. I thought, well, that's a fairly intimidating group, and I was beginning to question my decision. And then I asked the question, and I'm to lead a case discussion, like when I taught case Socratic discussion in graduate school. What's the case topic? And she said, oh, it's a big one. You'll like it. The case topic is America. Okay. So I'm intimidated by the case discussion topic. I'm intimidated by the group. But the real key was, what could I teach these people about America? And I thought about it, and I realized that the only real contribution I might be able to make is to ask a question, if I could come up with the right question. And so in the middle of the case discussion, I dropped a question. Is America dangerously on the cusp of falling from great to good? Or are we renewing greatness and we're in a positive inflection from great to a whole different level? The interesting thing to me was the room exploded into a debate. it ripped right down the middle, 50-50 debate on the question. And I was struck by how there was no correlation by sector. About half of the Army generals were on one side and about half were on the other side, and same for business and same for social sector. And then a critical thing happened during a break, which is a person who runs a very successful company that's at the top of the industry came up to me and he said, I think a more interesting question in some ways is, when you're at the top, when you can be insulated by success, when you have, you're in the most powerful position in your field, in your industry or your world or your field of academics or whatever, how would you know? If you think of it as that, you know, how would you know if, for example, you were ill, you think of stages of cancer, you could be at stage one or two before it's clear on the outside. What are early warning signs? Or how would you know if you were at a positive inflection if, in fact, most shifts to true greatness, the things are in place long before you see the obvious inflection, usually by years? What would you look at? The question stayed, and so we continue that conversation here today with a group of leaders from multiple sectors. And so this is my question for them. And we're going to begin with our panel. Where is America? Are we at an inflection point? What direction is that inflection point if we are at one? But most important, what tangible indicators should we be paying attention to today that would shed light? Not to answer, are we going great to good, are we going great to greater, but rather what do the indicators from different lenses perhaps shed light on the question? Our panelists to wrestle with us are come from each of multiple sectors. We have Senator Simpson, who comes from a history of legislative leadership and who will perhaps shed some perspectives on the legislative process. We have Bishop Jakes, who can speak from the question of a religious perspective. And what indicators might he see as us as a nation? We have Tom Stewart, editor of Harvard Business Review, who will perhaps be speaking from the business perspective and what we see there. And we have Judy Roden, who has spanned multiple sectors as a president of a university and a provost, working in the world of philanthropy today, and has business perspective from sitting on corporate boards. And we have the privilege of General Powell, who can perhaps speak from a broad global perspective looking back at the United States, a perspective perhaps none of the rest of us can have. So now let us turn to the question, and my role is to recede into the background. And Senator Simpson.
I missed the meeting before this. It often happens this way. Yes, yes, Jim, go ahead.
As one who has grown up in politics, and but in particular in legislative politics, the grinding gears where laws get made and executed and changed, the real engine, if you will, of our democratic process. Perhaps if it would be all right, I could start with you to shed some light on, one, what do you think might be essential to define as a great nation, and what indicators would you look at through the legislative lens that might shed light on how we're doing?
Well, first of all, my book sold only 20,000 copies. And I feel like a jackass at the Kentucky Derby. And the bishop sold 2 million. 2 million. You forgot the bishop's 2 million.
Won't report. I think the bishop has outdone all of us. Yes.
Well, I'm trying to get away from the question. I have it. First of all, I was a legislator for 31 years. If you want to go into politics, you want to decide whether you want to be an administrator or a legislator. An administrator would be a governor, president, all those things one would seek, or if you like to legislate. I loved legislating. I loved drafting the bills. I love the amending process. I love the hearing process. The hearing process makes you learn. You're sitting there. Nobody else shows up. You're the chairman of the committee. Everybody else says, I wish I could join you today, Al, but I can't. I have other things. So you're stuck for 4 hours or five, and you learn. And then you legislate, and then you manage a bill on the floor. There's a great pleasure in that, and ward off amendments or adopt amendments. And I enjoyed that. But legislating is the driest form of human endeavor. And so when you legislate, you can do 25 things on a bill in one day, and the only thing that gets in the newspaper is the most controversial part of the 25. So what I see today is the 24/7 impact of the news on legislating. There's no way a life can be examined on 24/7, and there's no way a legislative effort can be examined 24/7, because you'll always pick out the stuff, not the stuff, which is the dry stuff, which makes it work. And then you have to learn to compromise an issue without compromising yourself. And then you learn that if you do compromise, you're not a wimp. And this is how it has to work. And so, to me, what has happened is they've lost the art of legislating. It's now become, I have been sent here by this group that gave me this amount of money, and my campaign, they maxed out for me, and they've maxed out every year, and I have to stick with this point. And so you get into the compromise position, and they call and say, hey, pal, if you want us in the next election cycle, you better get off of that kick. And there's a lot more of that now. I would just say that we've come a long way, and it seems to me we've forgotten our history. These are not hideous times. 75 years after our declaration of July 4th, we had child labor, robber barons, and we're headed for a civil war. Whatever happened to the memory that we lost 700,000 in that war, brother against brother? As we pick away, I just think we should treat each other with a lighter hand. And we don't do that. It is a nation of scab pickers. They open them up. They start to heal and they open them up again. You start to heal and you open it up, and there's always somebody to open it up. Well, that ought to get things started anyway.
Just a real quick follow-up. Can you give me a sense for the degree of magnitude of how different that is today than when you went to Washington?
Well, when I went, there was no television in the U.S. Senate, and people were complaining about that. And then the House went to television, and then it was felt that we should. I voted for it eventually, but I resisted because I knew that it would be the usual workhorses and show horses, which is always the case. But I knew, too, that they would begin to play for that camera and for the next election cycle and for the film clip and for the clip against the opponent. And sure enough, you see campaign ads now which are directly taken from the cameras of the House and the Senate, and you see the show horses trying to get themselves on at 8 o'clock or 6 o'clock in their own time zone so that they can show off. It's an amazing system. We had one senator, we called him Old Prime Time. He knew just how to get on at every prime time. He was very good at it. That didn't answer your question either. Sure got a lot off my chest.
Bishop Jakes.
Oh, God. Steve, I'll be right with you.
You have a very different lens. You don't come from legislative politics, building in the world of spirituality, of religion, but in particular building the institutions of churches and people's spiritual lives. And I'm curious from your perspective how you would wrestle with the question, and more important, what indicators, intangible indicators, you would point to for us.
It's a very interesting time in the faith community and in the religious community, I think in part brought about by the infusion of technology. The moving away from the industrial age has affected the demographics of our communities, and largely affected how we perpetuate messages and ideas and concepts. And faith in its purest form, I'm concerned, is sometimes being hijacked, perhaps got a platform in recent years by books and movies and various things. We went from obscurity to notoriety, where people begin to recognize that there is a strong contingency of faith in America, which should be a very positive thing, in all the different forms of faith. It should be an indication that we have some inclination of what really matters in this country. And yet, some degree of arrogance is born out of it. As we look at the Passion of the Christ and the huge numbers it generated, as we look at books selling 23 million, 10 million at a time, not mine, but I was trying. yeah, I didn't get there. But that can be a good thing, but I think that we have to be careful that we don't allow our original purpose to be hijacked in the political machinery of the times that we live in, that we don't allow ourselves to be controlled or franchised by capitalism. And yet, it's naive to think that religion can remain totally autonomous from capitalism or from political inferences. Our challenges today is, how do we maintain the purity of our purpose while we take advantage of the technology of our times, and also identify with the fact that just because you're a person of faith doesn't mean that you're not a person with the same issues, concerns, and ideas of other people. I don't think that we have mastered that. If my purpose, if faith is the end-all objective, the destination, then it is an idle pursuit. I think that faith is more the lens whereby we see a bigger and broader world. And if we can find a way to incorporate that faith element into the fibers of being people and dealing with life and dealing with issues, I think that we could be a lot more comprehensive. Right now, we haven't done that because faith has become center stage. In secular worlds, we're struggling to understand each other's language. Sometimes we're misrepresented. Sometimes the people who speak the loudest for us are not really representative of the faith community, but they are the extreme polarities, either to the extreme left or right. And we have allowed ourselves to often be defined by our extremities rather than the central ideas of what faith was really meant to be. I think in some ways that summarizes some of the challenges that we face on a day-to-day level, dealing with people on a grassroots level. Economically, the people that we really seek to serve either went up through technology and corporations and education and academics, or in our demographics, we lost a large part of the middle class, because in the preceding age of industrialization, the average blue-collar worker could still make a good wage. Today, if you're not academically astute and well-trained, that divide is widening. A lot of the jobs have been shifted out, and people are in trouble. And whenever people are in trouble, faith becomes a lot more relevant than when they think they can handle things on their own. So faith shines the brightest when it is painted on the darkest canvas. And so this is a bright moment, because we need faith. And yes, it is, to me, the best of times. And yet, for many people, it is the worst of times. Our challenge as faith people is to bridge the gap between those who see it as the best of times, so that they don't get so caught up in their optimism that they don't lose sight that many people are in the middle of the worst of times. If we do that, we're going to live the rest of our lives with terrorists, both from external poverty outside of the United States and internal poverty that we are oblivious to within the United States. And we have to find a way, faith, politics, education, all working together, though we haven't mastered how to do that yet, to raise all people up to an equilibrium whereby we not only understand each other, we work in a comprehensive way to accomplish our goals and objectives.
Uh, Just a note, our first two panelists have already put a finger on the amplifying effect of technology as sort of amplifying strength or weakness. It's very interesting, just an observation. Tom Stewart, you and I have had many conversations over the years about a variety of things, but as editor of the Harvard Business Review and journalistic background at looking through the lens of studying business and economy, now we're putting a different leg on this, which has to do ultimately and maybe perhaps with our economic engine and the role of business and so forth. I'll let you take it where you will, but how would you come at the question of where we are, what makes great, but what are the tangible indicators you would point to?
Thank you. I mean, these are two really tough acts to follow, so I'm not going to follow. I'm going to go in a different direction. Our mission at the Harvard Business Review, as we define it, is to improve the practice of management and its impact in a changing world. And if you sort of take a look at some of the decompose that mission and look at how you might measure the quality of management in an organization or in a country, you might look at issues of financial and human capital, strategy, organization, and results. And so let me take a look at each of these four elements. Starting with the issue of financial and human capital, the great historian Fernand Braudel once observed that the United States is the only country in the history of the world that was built on borrowed money. It was fundamentally built on credit, built on debt. Economists have puzzled for many years over the fact that the United States behaves like a developing country. We take in more capital. We take in foreign capital all the time and take in more capital than we send out. And they say this can't be because this is only true of developing economies. And the paradoxical fact is that the United States is the world's richest and most powerful developing nation. It is still a developing nation. Capital comes to this country because it gets two things, a safe return and a high return, both in the same place. And no other country has that combination. The same thing has happened historically on the human capital side. I remember once being in a meeting in Nashville where some awards were handed out to a human resources group. And an award went to a Kim, to a Schmidt, to a Watanabe, to a Jones, basically to a rainbow coalition from around the world. And I thought to myself, you know, Henry Luce said the 20th century was the American century. Well, the 21st will be because we've got all your best people. And Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize winning economist, says, an expert on human capital, points out an interesting aspect of this. Newcomers, immigrants, are the people who give our economy tremendous flexibility because they go to new industries. You notice that the movie industry, when it was new in the 1920s, attracted a lot of Jews. They were immigrants. They had already said that they were not going to follow in their parents' footsteps, so they went into new industries. Information technology disproportionately attracted immigrants from South and East Asia. So immigrants provide talent that feeds into growing industries and is one of the reasons the American economy so quickly adapts. Now, both of these flows of human and financial capital, I think, are under some threat. The reaction to the Dubai ports deal is as nothing to the reaction that's going to come when China's currency finally revalues and there's significant foreign direct investment from China. How much foreign direct investment are we willing to take? We resisted Japanese investment a lot, and there's issues about that. In addition, the euro is now a safe place and very large. And India and China are big enough to absorb a lot of your risk capital and your growth capital. So there's real competition for foreign direct investment. And at the same time, we all know there's a domestic rise in xenophobia. And not only a rise in xenophobia with all kinds of stories about and barriers to entry for people, but also the home markets for a lot of these people are more attractive. So there's less reason for the brightest kids from India to come here than there was. So in both of these financial and human capital issues, I think we have some issues. If you then look at strategy, America's strategy, if you think about it, has been sort of aspirational leadership, the sort of Wilsonian tradition in American foreign policy, the idea of taking a moral and a high moral position. At its best, it is glorious. At its worst, it's vainglorious. At its best, it's missionary. At its worst, it's bullying. At its best, it's moral. At its worst, it's moralistic. At its best, it uses soft power, and at its worst, it uses hard power. I think we are right now at a time when we have been tending toward
the bullying, moralistic, hard power side rather than the aspirational soft power side that has been, in my opinion, the most successful thing. It's these things move in, these pendulums move back and forth. I think the pendulum is in the wrong side of that swing. If you look then to the third element of organization, large, great organizations fail slowly, to your point. I mean, General Motors has been failing for 3.5 decades or more, and it is still the world's largest automaker, I mean, for the next year or so. So one of the big questions is you know, when we have a risk of not seeing a problem, or on the other hand, we have a risk of exaggerating the weaknesses, of not seeing the strengths, or of denying the problem. And I think that we have sort of all the questions that organizations, that America has a question that all organizations face about how to actually, you know, face the facts and see the facts and get an agreed opinion on the facts, because there is a tremendous, this is, you know, still 25% of world GDP, still the largest economy in the world, going to be for all of our lifetimes and then some. And so we run the risk, I think, of underestimating our strengths, or on the other hand, of being overconfident. If I were to look at some tangible indicators, I would quickly look at innovation, and I'd give us a positive grade on that. I would look at the profitability of corporations in general and give us a very positive grade on that. I would look at the general flexibility of the economy and give it the most positive grade that you'd give to any economy and society in the world. If you look at the people, at the human capital thing, I'd give us a not so good grade, both on the area of flows and the area of stocks. I mean, how well are we doing training our own kids at home? On the area of distribution of wealth, which Thomas just mentioned, I think you have a real question about confusing getting rich with creating wealth. And I think we do run a risk of confusing these two things, particularly in the business community, of people thinking that getting rich is the same as creating wealth, and it's different. And I think we have a risk of national narcissism that shows up in the not invented here syndrome and a resistance to facing facts, and I'd give us a negative grade on those three. So I'd come right down the middle with some positive indicators and some negative ones.
Judy, you and I were talking beforehand about the notion of the social sector. And Peter Drucker, somebody we all admire, recently passed away, said that he felt that perhaps the future for society and for America would be saved by the social sector, that the government sector might fail, and even the business sector might become sick and in some ways have its struggles. We might lose faith. Disaggregation of risk and reward, as Tom was talking about. But the social sector is a beacon of hope for our future, and you've spent much of your life in the social sector. So taking that lens and however you'd like to come at it, and your years of working in the social sectors in various forms and what you do now, what indicators would you point to about where we are that you might draw upon, or any other lens you'd like to bring to it?
Well, I think reliance on the social sector is too significant a challenge. Government needs to play a role, the business sector needs to play a role, and the social sector is being animated into playing a more significant role. And they're not the social sector alone, but if we talk about civil society and the elements that build civil society. As we think about America and where our challenges are, Truman said the business of the nation is never finished. So the fact that we're confronting issues, that we're continuously asking ourselves questions about where we are and how well we're doing, mm-hmm. I think is a sign of the health of the nation as we go forward. If we stop asking those questions, we really do so, I think, at our peril. You talked about innovation. I'd like to pick up on that from my educational lens. We are still and will be for a very long time the leader of innovation. And the emphasis on science and technology, the emphasis on risk-taking and entrepreneurship that comes from the earliest fabric of the American spirit and is still very much alive today, I think needs to remain a really critical indicator. There are still more patent applications from the United States than from the entire EU. There are still more Nobel Prize winners today from the United States than from all of the rest of the nations combined. 1 in 12 Americans will try to start a business during some time in his or her lifetime. So we see this very, very much animated and elevated. On the other hand, we are being extremely challenged in terms of our investment in innovation. Our K through 12 education is truly in shambles, even more shameful because we invest so much in it and we see so little outcome for a very, very significant investment. We think of ourselves as a social meritocracy, and yet only 3% of applicants, of admitted students to the nation's top universities come from the bottom quarter of the population. We are taking an investment in science that has been the seed corn of American enterprise and American success, both economically, but I think also socially in terms of the values that we represent to the rest of the world. And we are disinvesting in science. So all of these things are critical indicators that we need to keep monitoring, and where in some places we're doing well, in some places we're not doing well. But think about places that we must continue to hold as values in our nation. President Kennedy said in his inaugural address that we'll be judged by how we treat the poorest among us. That's what a democracy is for, not for the rich. And we have higher rates of poverty, higher rates of infant mortality, and greater economic inequality than any other advanced democracy in the world today. That is a shameful position for America, a great nation, to be in. We have more uninsured citizens. We've heard here we're the greatest contributors to greenhouse gases per capita. All of these issues are indicators of our success, our greatness as a nation. And then I think finally, we have lost trust in our institutions as citizens. And I think that is a significant indicator of what will be problems in terms of our greatness. I think the silver lining here is that many studies and many polls show that Americans are far less polarized than our elected officials, that we agree about more things, that we have more values that we share in common. And so the ability, whether it's the social sector or government or the business sector, to build on that continued set of shared values and shared aspirations that have made America great, I think is what we'll need to rely on going forward.
You know, when you were talking, by the way, about silver linings, we're doing some research right now that looks at how companies prevail amidst disruptions that are out of their control. And in a highly disruptive world, they often really want to always revel in what are the difficult things we need to confront. And I love this one wonderful description of the days of Intel in their glory days of going through disruption, which was we could always find the black cloud and the silver lining. So. General Powell, you can bring a perspective that's almost the opposite of each of us looking through a sector of standing back and a global view and perspectives that might unify some of these themes and indicators. How would you come at the question, and what tangible indicators would you point to?
Well, first of all, I'd say that we are a great nation, and I think we have potential to be an even greater nation. I don't like a term that's frequently tossed around, we are the greatest nation, and I really dislike my good friend Tom Brokaw's capturing of the term the greatest generation, because there's greatness in every generation that America has ever had, from the first to the present. And as long as we believe that greatness can come out of this citizenry of ours, then I think the potential is there to go even higher. You said just now, you know, there's a black cloud in every
silver lining. And vice versa.
And you come to a conference like this, and you spend a lot of time talking about the black clouds. And you have to. You can't avoid them, the Iraq problems, the Iran and the North Korea problems. But when I sit down quietly late at night and look over 4 years as Secretary of State dealing with these problems, 4 years as chairman, 2 years as National Security Advisor, and I kind of do my ledger, I see that the great fears that we had in the post-World War II period, communism, having defeated fascism and Nazism, but communism, totalitarianism, colonialism, all gone. As a practical matter, all gone. Some little pockets remaining. But you should be very proud of the fact that as a result of United States leadership, we have succeeded in ridding the world of the prospects of world war in our lifetime and the lifetime of our children. Not to say all conflicts are going, but remember the kinds of conflicts we used to worry about are the kind of conflicts we were involved in the past century, and we should be very proud of that. As a Secretary of State, to watch these newly freed nations come out from behind the Iron Curtain, and they wanted to join things. And what's the first thing that they all wanted to join? The Baltic states, or Hungary, or the Czech Republic, the Slovak Republic, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria? What's the first thing they wanted to join? NATO. Also the European Union. NATO first. Why NATO? Why not a European security identity with the EU? No, NATO. My Russian friends and I would argue after the Cold War, why do you guys still have NATO? We got rid of the Warsaw Pact and you only existed for us and we're gone. It's hard to close a club down when people keep trying to join. And so NATO in the last 12 years has gone from 16 to 26 nations. Why? Because these newly freed nations want an insurance policy for a secure future. And the only ones they trust, United States of America. And that means get into NATO. It's been a source of joy for me. For example, Georgia in November of 2003 was on the verge of a civil war as there were these political forces trying to get Shevardnadze out of office. It was a weekend, I think, just before Thanksgiving, and my Russian colleague, Igor Ovinov, and I were trying to make sure this didn't explode. Some of my friends in government thought the Russians were going to send in Spetsnaz. I said, guys, that's over. They're not sending in Spetsnaz. I called Igor on his cell phone. Igor, dobry den, what are you doing? I'm going to go talk to Eduardo Shevardnadze. We'll give him my best, and let's figure out how to get out of this. And in 3 days, we solved the problem. Shevardnadze thought it wise to step down. And then in 2 months, we had a democratic election. I was privileged to be invited by the new president, Mr. Saakashvili, to come to his swearing-in. And I sat there watching the troops go by. Some of them marched like old Russian troops, and the best-looking troops marched like American troops because they'd been trained by American troops. And it was fascinating to watch this. And then he said, okay, let's go. We're going to have a town hall meeting. What do you mean a town hall meeting? You got all these guests here. Come, come. And he left every other foreign official sitting there on the inaugural stand as he and I went into the city hall of Tbilisi, walked into the city hall, and 20-foot flags were hanging from the ceiling. Only two kinds of flags, the Georgian flag and the American flag. We went into the council chamber. All of the city councilmen were there, and cameras were on it. And the brand new president of Georgia sat with the American Secretary of State, and we had a town hall meeting with the entire country. Fast forward, about a year later, the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine, when it was teetering as to what was going to happen with this flawed election, we made a statement. I came out and made a statement. The president made a statement a day later saying, the United States will not accept this. That brought such encouragement to Ukraine, and the Europeans followed suit. Alma and I went to the inauguration of the new president. And 5 minutes before his inauguration, Alma and I are sitting there, standing in this beautiful hall with he and his wife, wondering when do we get taken to our seats. And then suddenly they said, let's go. And we are following the president-elect into the chamber where he was going to be inaugurated. And I said, I don't think this is where we're supposed to be going. And they kept us right behind them until the last minute, when they brought us off to the side and put us with all the heads of state, even though we were heads of state. We still enjoy that kind of moral position in the world. When somebody wanted something done about the North and South in Sudan and how to end this war, and we succeeded in doing that, but it was American diplomacy and American leadership. We sometimes sell ourselves short about the impact that we're having on the world. And I have to slightly disagree with my colleague Tom in that I don't think Hitler would have responded to soft power. Sometimes it's hard power that is necessary to deal with tyranny, and there's nothing wrong when the circumstances require the use of hard power. You have to have soft power after that in order to go through a proper rebuilding process. So I have seen in the course of my years in senior levels of government an America that has shown its greatness. I see people trying to get into this country. Even though we've made it difficult, they still want to come. I went to a place recently, Choice Hotels, and spoke to 5,000 Choice Hotel franchise owners. And the guy who's in charge of the company says, oh, by the way, 45% of our franchise owners are Indian. Indian? Yeah. And they all come from the same state in India, Gujarat state. 45% of them? Yeah. One comes, opens a Choice Hotel or a Quality Inn or something, goes and gets brothers and cousins, and they all come over, and they all buy in, and they create little empires. There was a story in the Washington Post about Mongolian kids who came here, not a word of English, and 6 months later, they're speaking English near flawlessly and integrating. There are 12 million illegals in this country because they came here for opportunity. We shouldn't sell ourselves short on the greatness that we have exhibited to the rest of the world. And the fact that the rest of the world continues to look to us for inspiration, they continue to look to us to see how democracy is supposed to work. They're a little troubled by some of the things they are seeing now, and you heard that described earlier. They're looking at our institutions, and they're wondering, who are you to be lecturing us when you can't even seem to get your act together in Washington? Who are you to be lecturing us when it looks like civil discourse in the United States is going into the tank? Who are you to be lecturing us? So we have to talk about the greatness of our country, but not use we are the greatest you've ever seen. We've got to talk about democracy because we all believe in democracy. But what we have to help these countries do is reform themselves and create the institutions of democracy. Democracy just isn't a single election. It's the rule of law and institutions that give you the ability to create a democracy. So we have to speak a little softer. It was Thucydides that said that one of the greatest manifestations of power is restraint. So we have power. We have to use it in many ways, economically, militarily, morally, but use it with restraint and use it in proper measure. I share some serious concerns that were touched on by Alan Simpson and a few of the others with respect to the way our political process is going in Washington. Civil discourse is broken down. This whole business of earmarkings, everybody talks about it all the time. We heard it in the panel just before us. But there's something out of control when you go from 4,000 to 13,000 in a matter of 10 years, and an entire institution, the K Street Institution, has doubled and tripled in size. And everybody leaves Congress and goes to work there. It's corrupting our budgeting process. It's corrupting our appropriations process. And it's corrupting the confidence that the people should have in their elected officials. All the problems that Judy talked about with respect to education and what we have to do there, I couldn't agree with them more, and also with what Tom said, what all the others said. But there's one other thing that's bothering me, and I think it's been discussed in the media panels. It's getting harder and harder to get a clear message across to the American people that isn't immediately bent, shaped, mutilated, and totally destroyed with this wonderful information technology we have developed that moves everything around the world at the speed of light. And it doesn't make any difference anymore as to whether it's right or wrong or whether it's true or false. It's out there. And it's also created the celebrification of our society, and especially Senator Primetime and his colleagues, the celebrification of our society. And it is having a bad effect on our children as well. Judy says we spend a lot of money in K through 12. It's not just the money we spend in the schools. It's the environment we have in our society and the faith we need to put back into our families and into the parents of our children and to the caregivers of our children so that they give these kids the right values and a sense of shame. And so they all grow up like I think most of us in this stage grew up with our parents telling us, you have no choice. You're not going to shame us. You're going to go ahead and you're going to be a success in life. We didn't come to this country, my parents would tell all of us cousins. We didn't come to this country and work like dogs so you could screw it all up. So we're not discussing whether you're going to college. And if you drop out of high school, you're a dead man. We'll go get another kid. We don't need you. And somewhere somewhere along the line, we're starting to lose this ability to keep our kids on that path, especially in those disadvantaged communities of our nation, where there are those who are being further and further left behind, as has been discussed by my fellow panelists. And when you get that left behind, you're left behind. You can look at second and third grade literacy rates and predict the incarceration rate 15 years later. If you can't read by the time you get to fourth grade, you're lost. I've had a teacher tell me, generally come in at age six, their eyes are blazing, but it's not being reinforced at home. No one reads them at home. They're watching these absolutely stupid daytime television programs we have all over the place, the coarseness of our society, and by the time they're 9 years old, the light starts to go out, and you're losing these kids. And so I think we are a great nation. I think we can be a greater nation. Are we at an inflection point? I think we're always at an inflection point. It's a curve. It's a curve. It's a calculus. And we are always changing. We are always changing. And the beauty of this country is that it is such a resilient system. And we do have institutions that will allow us to change. And we do have people of confidence who believe in it. One quick anecdote. Everybody's telling an anecdote. But somebody touched on it earlier about investment coming to this country. When I was National Security Advisor to President Reagan, the Japanese were buying everything. And so one day we're sitting in the Oval and commerce guy comes in and trade guys come in. Oh, it's terrible. They just bought Rockefeller Center. They just bought Pebble Beach. Mr. President, we've got to do something about all of this. It's terrible. And Reagan just sat there kind of smiling. And finally, when he had heard enough of this, he's looked up and he says, well, I'm glad they know a good investment when they see one. It turned out they didn't. We got it all back. So don't lose confidence in this system of ours. Don't lose confidence in it, and don't let the black clouds cloud your mind.
We have a few minutes left. We're supposed to end in about 7 or 8
well,
minutes.
It's your fault, Judy.
Yes, and we have covered an awful lot of ground. And so what I would like to do is I would like to take a moment to highlight one theme that has come up and ask any member of the panels that would like to comment on it about this theme. We started off with the amplifier, the accelerator of technology. It's an accelerator of good and bad. We're seeing it for both. But it's an accelerator, it's an amplifier on either side of the coin. We have that. We also have, you know, this to me, I mean, this nation at its deepest level, running through all this conversation is a sense that this nation was founded on a set of fundamental core values. We hold these truths to be self-evident. We were an ideologically founded nation. And we have military power, we have business power, and we have moral power from having a set of values. But that amplification of the technology has made it possible, combined with whatever context we're in, for the debates to be very bitter, where we forget the shared values. And we seem to have this, almost every panelist has raised in one way or another, this sense of divisive yelling. As opposed to when I study companies that successfully go through inflection point after inflection point after inflection point, which is exactly right. They're always fear that they're in an inflection point. So they do the positive one because they don't want to do the negative one. There's healthy dialogue and debate and confronting of the facts with debate about what it means. Not yelling, not screaming, not arguing over what I get. My question for the panel is, if that's an indicator that is troublesome, what can we do to have vibrant, vigorous, real dialogue that produces a series of positive inflections as opposed to fracturing and arguing over practices when we really should be overvalued?
Can I correct your historical statement?
Yeah, sure.
I actually think that that's not correct.
Okay.
There are many historians who have studied the founding of this nation Tom Bender has written about this extensively. And he says that the founding of this nation and every other period was founded on really extraordinary debate, nastiness, yelling at each other, screaming at each other in the Congress.
Okay.
That it was a pretty vigorous... But what's wrong is that they didn't vilify one another. Okay. They finished screaming, and then they went out and had a drink together and married one another's children. And so the hatred, the animus, you know, it didn't seem the way it is now. So we have a thinning of the public discourse. It's not technology alone. I mean, that's amplifying it. It's allowing it to be broadcast all over the world. But we have to get back to a place where there really is an expectation that we share a common good, we have a set of values, we respect one another. It is harder in a multicultural society for America to do this. It is much more challenging because we may not now have a shared set of values. And so the beginning of the exercise is to reanimate the public discourse about what that shared set of values should be for the 21st century and going forward. What is that new social contract that America wants, that we expect of our citizens, that we expect of one another? That's the kind of discourse we need to have in this country.
Well, I think that's true. Let me just say that everyone in this audience and everyone in the country should guard against all of you people are amazing. You're amazing because you're here. Next time you hear something or see something, weigh it with this scale. Is it filled with emotion, fear, guilt, or racism? Because that's your trap. That's the way you pass or kill a bill. You use a deft blend of emotion, fear, guilt, or racism, and then the people get going. And the other thing is, and I taught this at Harvard. As I said, I couldn't have got into Harvard if I'd picked the locks, but I'll tell you. It was a wonderful experience. And I said to them, political correctness is like wearing duct tape over your mouth. Because if you are a person with bias and hate and ugliness and bile in your system and pretend that you're not and you're Mr. and Mrs. Goody Sweetpants, it's going to come through like a fissure in a volcano. And I think that's where a lot of rage comes from. It's people pretending, oh, I've never had a thought about a black person or a Jewish person. You know damn well they have, and they're pretending they don't. And it's the paternalistic crap of the First Order, and that's why my classes were like the Founding Fathers. We talked about everything. Homosexuality, Turkish, Greek, Irish troubles, abortion, and man, those were exciting classes, and that's the way this country was founded. Not with duct tape over your mouth and a phony kind of PC crap. I believe I've said it all.
I agree with you. For me, the challenge is because I totally agree that debate is healthy and that debate is good. And having spent a little time in South Africa, in some ways I thought that they were making strides in some ways that we were not, because we are so focused on being politically correct that we do that at the sacrifice of being absolutely honest. And so I concur and totally agree with the predecessor's comments that have been made before me. But the challenge that remains before us today is there a forum for this honest debate that doesn't get hijacked by someone who has an agenda? And when the debate is held, I don't see a contemporary forum for a lively, vigorous debate amongst people of opposing opinions who don't have a hidden agenda. We don't have a place to have a real family discussion.
I'd like to pick up on a point that Bishop Shakes made, which is the evisceration of the economic opportunity of the middle class, and particularly the working class man who didn't have much of an education but could get a good living working at a GM plant or something like that. I think that we will have a sort of a fractious, what's in it for me, can I cut my piece of the pie? Well, we will argue over crumbs of the pie if we cannot find a way to regenerate hope in the middle, you know, hope and progress and a sense of economic progress in the middle of the bell curve.
Absolutely.
I think that's crucial. And I think to this point of having these discussions, I remember back going to my
a history class on Parents' Day at my daughter's school. She was at Hunter High School in New York City with a lot of immigrant kids, and it was just when we were sending Marines in, or the Marines into Haiti, and it happened to coincide with the time when they were talking about the War Powers Act in the Constitution, and you know what 13-year-olds are like. They immediately get into right and wrong about everything, and was this right or wrong, and so on and so forth, and this pretty soon got away from the War Powers Act, and it got into all kinds of other rights and wrong, and whether it was permissible to dissent from war. And somebody told a story. He said, in my country, and he was from Pakistan, there was somebody who had a toaster that was a badly made toaster, and it caught on fire, and it burned the Quran that was on the table next to the toaster, and they were put in jail. And a kid from the Bronx raised his hand and said, over the Quran? I don't understand. I mean, it's not like he burned the flag or anything. And the teacher, who was a Buddhist of Jewish ancestry, just sort of looked there and said, man, this is a great country or what?
General Powell, do you think we can get out of the vilification and into healthy, vigorous debate?
Our founding fathers, as was noted, intended for there to be healthy, vigorous fights. The clash of ideas. But there was a reason for that clash, and that was to find areas of compromise. And from compromise, achieve consensus. That's what that whole system is about. That's the system that Alan grew up in and knows so well. I'm really worried, and I don't see an easy solution. I don't see the forum that the bishop is asking us for. I'm really worried because you look at your newspapers, you watch television, and everybody's peddling their angle. And you will read a columnist who is just absolutely wrong, and he must know he's wrong or she is wrong. And it doesn't make any difference as long as they can peddle their point of view. And I think we've become too tolerant of this kind of behavior. And when you look at a lot of our talk shows on television, and what you hear in the radio is something else, it's all coarseness. And if you say something, I happen to know a little bit about the Flag Amendment, having been opposed to it for the last 12 years. But I caught hell about that from time to time. And they'll try to throw racism at you. They'll throw patriotism at you. And it's getting harder and harder to get people to come out and expose themselves to that very kind of public debate. It was okay when, you know, they did the constitution writing in a sealed room where nobody could see what the devil was going on. And you ought to go back to it.
They wouldn't let the press within 100 yards of the building either.
Right.
Remember that?
And they took, other than what became the Federalist Papers, they didn't take many notes either. And I think perhaps it's just become, I don't want to say too wide open because that doesn't sound right, but we're abusing the wide openness that the information revolution has given us.
We honor time here at Aspen, and I would like to close our panel with two quick observations. The first is that the question is sort of a setup, and it's very clear when you look at healthy institutions, they do the constant inflection point thing infused by very healthy, vigorous, fact-based debate all the way along. What has occurred to me as we're sitting up here, maybe there is a forum. Maybe what's starting to happen here at Aspen, and we're all here, I mean, this was not vilification, and I mean, this has been a place where there has been emergence of dialogue. And perhaps, you know, if somebody else isn't going to create that forum and that stage for intelligent people to get together and dialogue and debate about the issues that need dialogue and debate, well, maybe we have one and we just make it, and we make it this. So I will close there with a thanks again to the Aspen Festival for creating that, and thank you to our panelists.
Well done, Jim.
Thank you.